Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Thank you all for joining us. The San Francisco Bay Area has been an incubator of important new movements in culture, cuisine, art, commerce, participatory democracy, media, and technology. A place where creative freedom and diversity continue to change the world, and brewing is central to it all. It's my pleasure to join some of the best informed and colorful figures in the craft beer movement as we review and describe this lively scene. Tonight, we host Zach Davis, the West Coast Regional Manager of Schmaltz Brewing Company, Forrest Gray, the founder and president of Speakeasy Brewery, Grizz, Luminos Grizz, and chief cook and bottle washer at San Francisco Brewcraft, and Sean O'Sullivan, the co-founder of 21st Amendment Brewery. We're going to be taking questions at the end. Hey, Grizz, let's get started. What's going on? What's it like to be chief cook and bottle washer?
Chief cook and bottle washer, I do a lot of talking to various people. Lots of women are learning how to brew these days. I'm kind of the odd man out here. This is a different end of the industry than these fine gentlemen do. They're on one end of it. I'm on the other. We teach a lot of new brewers how to brew. And so that's where I'm coming from.
Sean?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was a home brewer. I'm admitting it today. I home brewed for about a year and a half before I got involved, and it was guys like Grizz, who I've been to his shop many times, and a few others in the Bay Area, and that's kind of where what happened. There was a big push back in the 70s where people traveled to Europe and wanted to taste and tasted some great beers over here and came back and home brewed, and then when the law changed in I think it was 85, homebrewing became really popular, and then that was a natural extension of the craft beer scene from that. So I think all of us up here probably hadn't touched homebrewing at some time, so it's an awesome thing.
Sean, Congress passed that law in 78, which was the year SF Brewcraft started.
Oh, okay.
And I know because they wanted to bust me for homebrewing in 77. So, Forrest, you were also involved with SF Brewcraft.
I was. I used to homebrew myself a little, kind of an extreme level, about 10 gallons a week. Got all my materials at the Brewcraft. It's a good way to get started. I think everyone in the industry at some level, like Sean said, we're all kind of ex-homebrewers, or some of us still are. We actually have a homebrew rig at Speakeasy that we test drive some beers on, so we're still doing it.
And Speakeasy is still informed by the homebrew phenomenon?
Yeah, we still get calls from time to time. We give out some yeast to homebrewers that ask us nicely, come by and want a jar filled with some fresh yeast, which is always a good idea. But
Zach Davis, you're with Schmaltz Brewing Company. It's a bi-coastal company, both created, conceived, and based in San Francisco, and as well as brewing and bottling in New York City.
You got it. Yeah, so we were actually started over on Mission and Army, which is now the Comedy Traffic School, if any of you guys are familiar. Schmaltz Brewing Company make the Hebrew, the Chosen beer, which is America's Jewish celebration beer, as well as a newer brand, Coney Island Craft Lagers. So we were started here. And we've been brewing out of New York for the past several years, and I'm probably the only person up here that didn't come from a home brewing background. I kind of got into home brewing once I got the job and then had to learn how to talk to people about beer, and so I explored home brewing as a way to educate myself about what I was doing.
You could have at least lied to us about that, by the way.
I've homebrewed for 29 years.
There you go.
Zach, I think I got it wrong. I don't think it's New York City. It's actually Saratoga Springs,
Saratoga
a division
Springs.
Of Mendocino Brewing Company,
right.
Still a Bay Area connection. From, is it Sonoma? No, Mendocino County.
Yeah, we're representing. We're doing what we can. We were initially brewed out of Anderson Valley. You guys are probably familiar with Anderson Valley. And we were brewed out of there during the beginning of our life and then switched our production and switched our location and switched our contract all the way over to Mendocino Brewing Company, who is local, but we decided to use their East Coast location. I think there are more Jews in New York. And so we wanted to be.
There were Jews everywhere. As a matter of fact, King David was a brewer, and for many years the six-pointed star was the Star of David was the sign of a brewery, whether they were Jewish or not.
Yeah, that was going to go on our label, but it was copyrighted.
by whom? A higher power, right. Let's zoom out for a second. In an age where haute cuisine and heirloom varietals of various produce are big, we don't want to see a signature on every carrot, yet artisanal beer is very important and booming. So for those who are not really familiar with why craft beer is important, Sean, can you please describe what it is that's magic about brewing in this way?
Well, it's the alcohol. No, it's, I mean, seriously, it's what's happening right now in terms of craft beer is really a natural extension of what's happening with what Bob just said with slow food movement, and we're all concerned and becoming more and more concerned with what we put in our mouths. So whether it's that, you know, that cheese that you really enjoy that's made nearby, or that you know, Prather ranch beef, or something that's made in a kind of a holistic natural way where there's not that much impact on the environment or on you, it's really a natural extension of that. And everyone up here is concerned about that as well. And I think you're seeing more and more with more products coming out, organic products in the craft beer scene as well. And it's just a great thing right now.
You know, the important thing to me about home brewing or brewing in general is not particularly the product you get out the in the end, which is good beer. It's the process that's the most important thing. And if you have a passion for any kind of a process, throwing a pot, making beer, playing a saxophone, you have to learn how to do it from the beginning to the end. You have to learn the process. I learned how to homebrew. I was working on the Navajo Indian Reservation for 30 years. And it was a high-tension job, and I wanted to do something that would get myself ironed out. And so I brewed on the weekend, and it ironed me out. I took the 2.5 or 3 hours, and I got myself ironed out. And if you enjoy doing this thing, and it's a really good hobby, and it's a cheap hobby, costs you $300 to go snowboarding for a weekend. Cost you $75 to get on a green, and you for $150 you can have everything, you can get yourself set up in a home brewing outfit, and then find out if you like to do it. I always tell people, do this a couple of times, and if you don't like doing it, there's one thing that I know for sure: life is too short. And if you're old enough, you know what I'm talking about. And so you don't want to. A lot of people want to turn this into an anal retentive, neurotic nightmare. And if it turns into an anal retentive neurotic nightmare, you want to throw a pot or learn how to play a saxophone or learn how to play golf, because life is too short, but it is a lot of fun if you get into it. And then you get the reward. It's sort of like instant karma of tasting beer and sharing beer that you made with your own two hands with your friends and relatives. And that's enough, but the day I shared a beer with my old man, our relationship changed entirely. When he drank a beer that I made and he liked it, and we sat down and had a nice conversation. It might have been the first conversation we ever had.
For more of the Grizzian philosophy, which is beautifully put, go to the website that you've created at SF Brewcraft, because there's a link there. Why brew beer? Why do it? And it's amazing. I mean, in short, it's not only economical, but it's healthy, it's relaxing, it's creative. It combines artisanship, altruism, you can share it, it's socializing, it's a long-standing ritual, it connects us with diversity of cultures and aesthetics from around the world, you can test yourself and aspire to excellence, you can learn about the world and learn about science and the process and the chemistry and the earth, and it's a pleasure. And it's all there, and all those things tie together with this arc of history. Forrest, I mean, you came to it pretty much the same way. You gave up being a chemical biologist, right?
Yeah, I was an immunologist before I got into this. People ask me why I started a brewery. I really can't answer them very well at this point. But I made a lot of beer, and somehow I got sucked into it. Yeah, I mean, I think the other side of what Chris is saying, too, is that when you develop the passion when you go through the process, and everyone up here, we all have passion for what we do. And I think you see, in contrast to that, when the big brewers, you know, Anheuser-Busch, when they try to attack us and try to make a quote, craft beer, they really just don't know how. And it's fun to watch. Actually, I've been watching it now for, you know, closing in on 15 years, I guess. I've been kind of at least a spectator, if not a player in this market. But, you know, when the Shock Tops and the American Ales come out, we all kind of laugh a little bit. Like, here they go again, you know, because they just don't have the passion for it. And they have these, you know, marketing guys that are looking at numbers, crunching out spreadsheets and say, okay, well, apparently this is the amount of alcohol you need and this is the color you need. And, you know, then they make this beer and nobody buys it. And then they go back to the drawing board and try again. But they just need to find the passion and they just aren't looking in the right place.
Yeah, now we're getting down to it, Forrest, because the title is Get Wiser Than Bud. Now we're going to talk about getting wiser than Bud. Because, you know, I mean, when you go into the supermarket, for example, it's Consolidation City. And it's almost, it's, you know, although there are more options in the marketplace, it's some of the features look like, again, 1978, when we started to look for, you know, other alternatives in home brewing, et cetera. I mean, Anheuser-Busch was purchased by InBev of Belgium, right? So basically we have Anheuser-Busch InBev, SAB Miller, which has Molson Miller has a joint venture called Miller Coors, right? So then you have Heineken International and the Diageo monolith on the Guinness and the other things. Mm-hmm. So basically, when it doesn't matter if it says Pabst, because it's contract brewed by Miller from the Pabst Brewing Company and some other labels that are historic. And, you know, Forrest, you're saying that basically there's a little bit of a fighting back because people want to drink what tastes good and what's healthy.
Yeah, it's like what Forrest said. It's, you know, we're creating trends up here. I mean, we're like the guys out here creating new flavors, doing weird, wacky things, putting, you know, craft beer in cans. It's wacky. And basically the big...
It's not wacky, Sean.
The big monolith breweries out, the Budweisers, the, you know, the Coors Miller, whatever they're called today. I mean, they're the ones that are following us. They don't know what they're doing when they try to create like the Blue Moons, the Shock Tops, these beers that are sort of the entry level beers for a lot of people into craft beer. Hopefully not. They don't. It is funny. It's humorous because they cannot sell it. There's an organic beer that's out that's put out by Anheuser-Busch. It doesn't say it's brewed anywhere. It's from Anheuser-Busch. I think I don't know the name of it. I don't want to bash them too hard here, but it doesn't feel right. It doesn't taste right. And I think that's the big thing between us and them. I always make the statement that it's not that we always have this like, oh, it's the David versus Goliath kind of thing. It's not really that way, in my opinion. They're completely separate. I mean, we're making, you know, really great beer, and they're making okay beer. It's really about the real argument, I think. The real discussion is about the marketplace, about the fighting for space, for shelf space, because they really crowd you out when you're trying to put your bottles or your cans in those places. That's the real, real problem. So
notice, Sean, they don't say Budweiser, the crown prince of Belgian beer.
They don't.
But, you know, but they do. I want to ask you, Zach, yeah, the marketplace is that way, but there's a larger issue also, and that is just as corn has found its way into the feed for, you know, for the farms, for the corporate farming, and corn has also, you know, found its way into other beverages, soda, you know, through the high fructose corn syrup, and all the corn is just permeating the food and beverage scene. So now we start to look at the corn adjuncts in beer as part of that context, right, Zach?
I think that part of the argument certainly extends to this whole like local organic movement, the omnivore's dilemma type of argument. I think my experience with corn and brewing has kind of related itself back to the quality of the products going in, and I think that you know, you see corn going in as kind of a filler, as a cheap ingredient that's used to create a light flavored product. And, you know, there are some breweries around the world that are using ingredients like corn and ingredients like rice in their beer, but they're using it in a well thought out way. And so they're using it, you know, they're using it to put out a good product. I think when you're using it as an excuse, you taste it and I taste it and the people who buy the beer taste it and the people who see the commercials taste it.
Well, we're talking about
there's
corn.
There's a reason for that. There's a reason for the commercial beers, maltose, what beer is made, the primary ingredient in beer is maltose, and it's not 100% fermentable. There's unfermentable sugars, dextrins, that are left behind, and that's what gives beer its body and flavor. Dextrose is 100% fermentable. You can ferment it down to water. And what you got left at the end are a few esters and water and alcohol. It has no character, no flavor, no anything. So if you wind up putting a bunch of 100% fermentable sucrose, dextrose, fructose, doesn't make any difference what it is. If it's 100% fermentable, you wind up with a beer with no body and no character that you have to damn near freeze to be able to stomach to drink it. And that's what American lagers have turned into. And those adjuncts that everybody was talking about just do nothing but create a thin-bodied, sort of characterless beer. So that's my take on that. I mean...
Well, then there's also oil involved, not just corn, and that is the manufacturer sometimes is so remote that the transportation issues come into play. We're all local, and to have a local product that arrives fresh and that doesn't have a huge carbon footprint is something that we all care about or ought to, don't you think, Forrest?
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think that my bud Sean here has been selling beer in cans for a while, and that speaks to that point pretty clearly. Beer's like bread. There's a few exceptions. There's a few beers that we age like a wine, but for the most part, beer should be drank soon after it's made. And I don't put beer in cans yet. I put beer in bottles currently, but the best container to ship beer in, for a lot of reasons, are cans, not bottles. And one of the predominant reasons for that is the fossil fuel consumption. Bottles are very heavy. I feel kind of dirty, frankly, when I pour my beer out. I still have this very heavy thing in my hand that has been transported all over the planet. I would speak to consumers of good beer right now and say, please, you know, let's look at this issue, because the only reason why we all don't put beer in cans is because our marketing people are afraid. I'm not very afraid anymore. I've been talking to a lot of people about this for years, and Sean's been doing it again for a while here, but this is the future of craft beer. It's actually the better answer for all reasons. And I'm saying that, and I don't even put beer in cans yet. So I'll let Sean take the mic.
Yeah, cans are, for all those reasons that what Forrest said. And the reason that a lot of craft brewers haven't been doing it is because it's been a hurdle to get it to market. There wasn't a lot of equipment available for craft brewers. We're small, little artisanal brewers. We use smaller bottling lines, packaging lines. And so there were some companies that started to build smaller systems that we had access to. The other hurdle was that... that the can manufacturers had these huge minimums that you had to purchase. So you had to buy a million cans, and to go through those in a very small way would have been ridiculous. Unless you wanted to change your label somehow, you had these cans because they come pre-printed. So that was the big hiccup. And the other one was you guys.
Yeah, that's the big one.
Everybody who looks at a can kind of shudders at it. Maybe you guys don't do that here because you're here to taste good beer.
It's a smart audience, Sean. Give some credit.
Praise the audience. Always praise the audience. I always say that, you know, your first beer probably was not a good beer, and it may have come in a can. We always say that, bad beer is bad beer, and canned beer is just a package. And so, and the other thing is, it's just basically a large tank, a small tank. Excuse me. We use these big stainless tank. The beer is in metal its whole life until it gets to that package, and it might still be in metal when it gets into a keg. So it's not that big of a deal. So I think you're right. You're going to see more and more breweries doing it. New Belgium's doing it. I just heard that Sierra Nevada is going to go into it. It sounds like Forrest is going to do it next week. So you know, welcome to the can club.
Well, it's an innovation, or it's also, you know, I mean, we've been speaking about local, we've been speaking about innovative packaging, we've been speaking about in a way, a grassroots kind of approach to what can be a very monolithic industry on the big boy scale. So let's speak for a moment, Grizz, about the rebellious spirit that comes from San Francisco that harkens back to counterculture, to what was emerging in the 60s and 70s, not only in brewing, but also in other aspects.
Well, I hate anything that's stereotyped. You try to get away from it. It might be interesting. This might be an interesting little thing. Everybody thinks that brewing started with the Egyptians. That's the sort of the thing. It started so far before the Egyptians. It started when the hunters and gatherers stopped to grow grain, the beginning of agrarian civilization. That's about 65,000 years ago. And they had these big piles of grain laying out in the, and barley, malted barley means barley that's been sprouted. When grains get sprouted, they develop an enzyme that breaks down the complex carbohydrates into simple sugar, and that's what the yeast can assimilate to make alcohol and carbon dioxide. The most important fact in all of brewing, and this is anticlimactic, is that carbon dioxide is heavier than air. There's nothing more important than that understanding when you're a brewer, because you want to make your beer anaerobic as quickly as possible, so you lessen your chances of contamination. So anyway, they had these big piles of grain laying out on the prairie, and they got wet, and they sprouted. And then it rained again, and some of that enzyme digested the complex carbohydrates that were in the pile of grain, the endoderm. And so they had puddles of sugar water at the base of the these piles of grain. Well, wild yeast got in there, Pediococcus or who knows what. Wild yeast got in there and fermented it. And beer is an enculturated taste. I mean, it's like carrying a turd around your head. After a while, you get used to.
That's awesome.
After a while, you get used to it. I mean, we learn what the flavor of beer is. So they didn't know any different. They got down and they got their gourds, and they drank that beer that had alcohol in it, and then they stood up and everybody started to look good. And everybody started looking good. It's like midnight at the bar. And then they wound up in a big pile. Well, after a couple of thousand years, they started to say, why is it every time we drink that water, we wind up in a big pile? And so they started to look at that grain pile, and after about 2,000 or 3,000 more years, to see what was happening there, they started to figure out what the process in general of what brewing was about. I mean, this is one of the oldest rituals in agrarian civilization. And whether you intellectualize that or don't think about it at all, to be connected with an endeavor that's been going on for 60 or 65,000 years is a very, very cool thing.
Well, no wonder, Grizz, the way you put it, it explains all the taxation and the prohibition and all the efforts to clamp down on what's essentially a very human activity. And again, let's look at the forest. When you go, let's say we're having a party.
Tree falls, will anyone know?
We're having a party, right? We want some of the magic that Grizz just described. We go into the store, or we visit the brewery to get a pail or a growler and fill up, or we're making it ourselves, and we're going to have a party. What is it that we're looking for that we can't necessarily find in the beer section at Safeway?
Well, you know, Safeway's geared towards the big brewers. They deal a lot on price points. They're very concerned about price points, which sometimes is not in our best interest. We're not trying to get rich on this. It takes a lot of time and energy to make what we make. We're an artisan industry, and they're not quite familiar with that concept, I think, to the extent that they should be. So you're not going to get the cross-section that you might find in your... there are some stores out there. There's stores like Whole Foods that have been doing a really nice job promoting really quality products and cans, actually. keep plugging my buddy Sean here. But yeah, you have to look around. But again, I think you're going to find, hopefully in any given geography, you're going to find the quality representation, the beer that represents the market best.
Zach, one of the things that's said about the aspects of beer as a food or on the table for meals or at a party is that it pairs really well with food because it's carbonized in the heating process, unlike wine, that it's carbonated because of the nature of the fermentation. And you know, what's your experience, especially from the perspective of the New York cuisine as well as the San Francisco cuisine?
I'm definitely a beer guy, but in my experience, there are so many more ingredients that you're able to add to beer than you're able to add to wine. And I think that the combination of different malts, the combination of different hops, the combination of different adjuncts, which are basically added ingredients that you would put in. So, for instance, you know, Sean's watermelon, wheat watermelon would be considered an adjunct. You know, you're really able to pull so many different complex flavors, complex aromas, complex textures out of that, that it really lends itself to pairing really wonderfully with different types of food. And I think that, you know, you can pair beers with really any type of cuisine, no matter where you are, no matter what you're trying to do. You know, you can pair it with the spiciest Indian food all the way down to the most kind of subtle and delicate, you know, seafood. And you can really find ways to either complement the flavors of the beer, complement the flavors of the food, or to contrast them, which really allows you to re-explore kind of the concept of both of those things in that like shared context, I guess.
For example, Sean would, you know, pairing cheeses or chocolates, as many of our friends do with beer, or other cuisines.
Yeah, it's the great thing about beer is that you always go to your wine and cheese parties, and wine is limited in what it has. Just like Zach said, you've got light flavors, you've got roasted flavors, sweet flavors, bitter flavors. And the great thing about having, like, if you pair cheese and beer together is that beer has carbonation in it, and it actually scrubs your tongue. It kind of removes that fat layer, which was what cheese is basically, is fat, and allows you to cleanse your palate and allows you to enjoy, you know, another bite or a different type of beer with another type of cheese. So there's just so many other options out there that you don't have with wine. There's a lot of great material out there. There's The Brewmaster's Table by Garrett Oliver is a fantastic book on food and beer pairings. You just got to seek it out.
Sean, thing about the fermentation process that's shared with cheese making and bread baking, it's a little different in brewing. For one thing, we do deal with the alcohol aspects, and you don't get a hangover from cheese the next day, or you might deal with
I've had a lot of cheese. I've gotten hangover.
You got hangovers from cheese. And so again, the idea of temperance versus prohibition. Your business, for example, deals with the liberty seeking repeal history. And really, I mean, the repeal of prohibition was such a huge liberating time in American culture that we're still celebrating, yes?
Yeah, it's actually ironic. You've got a brewery here, Speakeasy. You have a beer called Prohibition, and then you have the 21st Amendment here. So
we celebrate the dark side, John.
Exactly.
Sorry.
We're like, I'm like, it's like good versus evil, yin-yang up here. Yeah, it's absolutely that. You know, once those 13 dark years ended, sorry, Forrest, you know, December 5th, 1933, when the 21st Amendment was passed, it allowed people to sort of come out of those speakeasies and see the light and enjoy what was being probably hidden away and consumed and taken over from Canada for a long time. So, yeah.
Brewing is such a great American tradition. When FDR signed the 21st Amendment, he's reported to have said it's a good time for a beer.
Yeah, he did.
And Will Rogers, he was asked about the possibility of prohibition. He said, the South is dry and will vote dry. That is, everyone sober enough to stagger to the polls. But the thing about it is that even during prohibition, there was sacramental beer. There were medicinal allowances for beer. Prescriptions were written. So the idea is that the total prohibition makes no sense, even though a true temperance does.
It was kind of it was a failed experiment for us. I mean,
don't blame me.
Well, I'm not. No. I was just going to say that one of Forrest's coasters at the Speakeasy is the prohibition prescription, the prescription for alcohol. And it's ironic that you would get this from your doctor, but it was a terrible period in a lot of ways because and then it really changed in a lot of ways because we needed the money. You know, we were coming off of a really dark period of time back in the early '30s, and we needed money. We needed to put people back to work, and that was kind of the end of it.
Some of the best cheerleaders for the Bay Area beer have come from overseas, like the beer writer Michael Jackson loved coming here and loved West Coast highly hopped beers. And Peter Bookert, the brewer at New Belgium Brewery in Fort Collins, Colorado, he's come from the brewery in Rodenbach Brewery. In Belgium and come to the United States and really embraced American art, culture in a brewing context. Like he calls himself the Jackson Pollock of beer. He's a brewer. He says that beer, the enjoyment of a portion of beer, is like the experience of art. And Zach, I mean,
exactly.
Grizz, you want to jump in on
it? It is art. It is art. I think it's art. And you have to treat brewing beer as an art. And that means you can't learn how to do it in 2 days. It means that every time you brew, you learn something. I brewed for 40 years, and every time I brew, I learn something. And it's either about myself or about something. And so you always have the anticipation of discovery, and which makes it another really neat thing to do. But it's art. And a culture where everything comes in bites. We're starting to think in short little bites. Our brains are starting to work that way, but when you learn how to brew, you have to do it for a while in order to get the skill to be able to do certain things. And there's no way around that. You have to have the skill, and you can't get the skill if you want to sing the blues. You got to pay your dues, period. there's no way around that. And we all should pick something that's slow in developing. And that's why I harp on this all the time about, in this day and age, take something where you disconnect for 2.5 hours. You don't want to brew with your cell phone on. You don't want somebody jerking your chain every 15 minutes while you're brewing. You want to take that 2.5 hours, put on the Grateful Dead or Beethoven's Fifth, or Metallica, or whatever you listen to, take that 2.5 hours and iron yourself out, and then turn the cell phone back on. I was fly fishing in northern New Mexico about 3 months ago, and I was beautiful northern New Mexican day, cumulus clouds flying overhead, 65 degrees. And there's a guy out in the middle of the stream below the Navajo Dam there, fly fishing with a cell phone in his ear. And he looked stupid. He looked like a monkey. He looked like a monkey screwing a football. And he looked like a fat boy eating an ice cream cone. He looked like a 12-year-old girl smoking a cigarette. It looked stupid. And if you brew with your cell phone on, you look stupid.
Grizz, I mean, it's very challenging, in other words.
I know, we're on radio, and I can't say that kind of stuff. It'll probably get...
Grizz, we're never going to hear this on the air.
It's a great point. Grizz, it's a great point that it's challenging to brew well, and that's part of
it is a challenge.
But it's very accessible to start. And Zach, I want to talk about the fact that it's so easy to enjoy also as a drinker, as somebody who drinks the beer, who buys the beer, and part of the themes that the Schmaltz line and the Hebrew lines of beers are they do chosen beers and they do freak beers. So the chosen beers are the Jewish traditional themes, and the freak beers are the New York sideshow circus related Coney Island beers. And it's just such a wonderful American bifurcation there. So the For me personally, coming from Lenny Bruce's hometown, you have a beer that's a tribute beer to Lenny Bruce, a free speech icon in performance comedy that has a strong New York and San Francisco connection.
So Jeremy, the owner of our company, was doing a radio interview, and he was asked by the reporter, so Schmaltz Brewing Company is moving away from the Jewish themed beers. They're moving to this these freak show themed beers. Schmaltz going mainstream? And he said, well, if circus freaks are more mainstream than Jews, I guess so. I always thought that, you know, I thought that it kind of sums it up, you know. It's all about the experience. It's not just, and I think any of these guys will be able to agree with me, it's not just about the actual product that you're buying from the store and you're putting in your mouth. Everybody here is striving to create a connection with you guys, with the customers, and striving to create an experience that's more than the experience that you're going to get watching, like, a guy in a bear suit skiing down a mountain in order to sell a new can of some beer that you may go by and you may not go by, but I can guarantee as you drink it, you're not going to have the same sense of self-satisfaction that you're going to have drinking something that you know was thought about and played with, and there were failed experiments. And when you get to that one experiment where you're like, oh, man, this is actually really delicious, there's nothing quite like that, you know? And all these guys have experienced the failure, and so, you know, it definitely makes the success sweeter. And I don't remember what the original question was. I think that story is so good.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be taking your questions in about 5 or 10 minutes, so if you want to begin lining up at the microphone, this would be a good time to start formulating those questions. And to continue the discussion, I think that one of the themes we've explored tonight is that, you know, this is a pretty radical endeavor still, that a lot of us are challenging the received notions of what this product is, what it does for us, and the place it occupies in our lives. And I think the Bay Area has a specific story to tell about the burners, the hackers, the innovators. And it seems to me to go all the way back to the Gold Rush days and steam beer and innovating with what we had, improvising, in the same way that music, art, and other aspects of our society were different here. Forrest, can you speak to that?
What are you asking about here, Bob?
Well, Forrest, you're a pretty iconoclastic guy. You're not a conventional person.
I'll take a stab at it. I think the West Coast in general, I think, has a great reputation for making beers that are hoppy. We kind of took your English style ales, kind of cleaned them up, you know, maybe brewed them the way the Germans might, and then add a lot of hops on the top end of it. And I would say California and the West Coast, however, I think SoCal's just picking up on what we're doing, which is great to see. You're probably seeing that too. But it's kind of interesting. The further east you go, in general, there's spots, but hops tend to kind of go by the wayside as you go east. It's definitely a West Coast tradition, and we're proud to be a part of it. We certainly didn't start it, but we're happy to be a part of it.
Well, the one figure you're probably referring to who certainly makes a beer with a fair charge of hops in it, at least it was back when it was started, was Fritz Maytag. With Anchor Brewing Company, when he bought that brewery, I think it was 1968, for just $1,500. And he really was the one that kind of sparked the reason that a lot of us are up here in a lot of ways. He was practically the first, I think, microbrewery behind New Albion up in Mendocino County. And it was a guy like that who kind of saw the vision at the time, who could have, you know, stayed with his family's Maytag, you know, dishwashing business, and decided to get into craft beer and now cheese, and really decided to, you know, make a go of it and see what would happen. And I think all of us probably remember that first Anchor Steam we had, and he took that whole tradition of where the Germans had come over way back when, and we didn't have proper refrigeration out here in the Bay Area, so they used these big cool ship fermenters, basically, to cool the wort down. And the beer was, they were using a lager yeast, which typically ferments at lower temperatures, but they couldn't do that here, so they fermented at higher temperatures, producing kind of an ale-like fruit flavor, fruit aroma as well. And it was a guy like that who kind of took a chance and decided to reinvent the whole steam bear phenomenon, which occurred way back in the 20s and 30s, and allowed all of us to basically beer up here. I mean, I would say that he's probably one of the important people that led us on our trail.
Absolutely. He loved some of the English beer styles and had traveled there and came back and started brewing a porter, for example, and then pale ales and India pale ales.
Yeah, let's not forget about Liberty.
He's a really good guy.
You know,
Fritz Maytag is a really good guy besides everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Liberty, too. I mean, let's give that credit as well in and of itself. I mean, that started the IPA movement, you know.
Exactly. And one of the things that happened then when we started to interpret the world's beer styles, sometimes we reinvigorated their beer culture back where it started, beer styles that were fading. I'm thinking, for example, of some of the Belgian experiments that we're seeing here and in the Bay Area, and also the purchases of beer styles that then became an important part of the industries in their home countries.
Well, it's interesting because Belgian beers are really hot right now. You've got a lot of pretty big players out there. You've got Russian River Brewing Companies making phenomenal beers, Vinny up there. You've got Tommy Arthur down at Lost Abbey down in San Diego. And it's almost like a new world Belgian beer in a lot of ways, where we've taken this small little country about the size of, Connecticut or Wisconsin, and we've taken their beers. They have crazy beers. Have you ever had a Belgian beer? They've got spices in them. They've got these really funky flavors and characters to them. And in a lot of ways, we've probably saved those styles by brewing them here. And then in turn, what's happened is that conversation has gone back across the Atlantic, and now you're seeing Belgian breweries that are starting to do sort of American hoppy beers. Sort of those American hops that Forrest was talking about are now finding their way in those beers. And the other thing that's happened is that we're buying those Belgian beers, so you're seeing a lot of Belgian beers being imported in this country. There's this great Guz brewery in Belgium, Cantillon, in Brussels, that does a spontaneously fermented beer, and 20% of all their production comes to the United States. This is a really small brewery. We've really saved those small artisanal breweries that would have been lost to the Jublers, to the Stella Artois of the world, which are all Belgian, you know, based breweries, that's all macro large breweries in Belgium.
Sean, that's great. I mean, 20 years ago, it was really hard to find good beer as we traveled through even our region, and certainly, you know, out of the region. It was very hard to find good products of the flavors that we had come to enjoy. So let's look at what we might be looking at 20 years from now. Now that we've accelerated this progress so much, anybody care to venture? Everyone will be home brewing at home, Grizz, right?
Well, yeah, I'm safe that way. I think one of the new trends, is things go up and down. It's beer one year more than wine. Next year, it's wine more than beer a little bit, and you know, everybody goes trendy. What's happening right now in the business, I think one of the biggest movements, and these guys are going to be shooting darts at me, but I think it's making spirits, distilled spirits. Distilled spirits is coming. There's a lot of, I sell stills, and it's illegal to own a still and make alcohol
with it.
What
do you call it, then?
Well, you can make distilled water with a still. You can make make essential oils. I don't know what you're going to do with it when you get out of there. I did have one guy bring me in a rye whiskey that would literally knock you over. It was better than anything you could buy, and it was an amazing rye whiskey. And so people are starting to do that in their garages. I don't think the revenuers are going to come and bust you in your garage. They will if you sell it. Then that's Port Leavenworth. And if you make a quart of rye whiskey here and there, I don't think, you know, for medicinal purposes.
Part of the mystique of the Scotch whiskey is that they were running from the revenuers and that they were in the Highlands, and they were starting with beer. Before they condensed it in their still, they made beer and then the whiskey.
You know, what these guys are saying, I want to support this can thing. There's a lot of folk myths in brewing, and they're really dearly held myths that people don't want to break. And one of the myths is, you know, it's like albino alligators in the sewer kind of stuff. And and one of the things is that something that comes out of a can you know, it used to be that if you drink Coke out of a bottle, it tastes a lot better than if you drink it out of a can. That's a psychological aberration. And it's just psychological. And so drinking beer out of a can, if it's good beer and it's convenient and you can stash it easier and you can put it in your refrigerator and you're not breaking any bottles in the meantime, is a perfectly legitimate way to drink good beer. And so you just have to get over sort of the folk myth that drinking something out of a can deteriorates it in some sort of a way or another. I don't believe that. And obviously they don't, and neither should anybody else, really. You shouldn't stop at buying a can of good beer and buying a beer in a can. I don't know.
Hey, Zach, as people do get wiser than Bud, right? In 20 years, what do you think we're going to see?
Ooh. Well, I definitely agree. I think that the movement, people are focusing more and more on what they're drinking, it's extending past beer, and you're seeing boutique spirits, boutique wines. I think that for a long time, the majority of craft beers you've seen have been these ale-style beers, and I think that's for a variety of reasons, but I think in some respects, the big beer houses have owned the lager category with the Bud Light and the Miller Light and the Coors Light, and brewing ales gave craft beer a way to differentiate. It was also less labor intensive and less expensive. But now you're starting to see, you know, more and more craft brewed lagers coming out on the market. And just over the course of the last, 8 months or so, you're seeing more and more interpretations of those lager styles. Like Sean was saying, the access to the canning line was unavailable for a long time, and now it's become available. And I think that the access to the means by which to produce these lager-style beers, which you need lower temperatures, you need more ingredients, you need more time, are also making themselves more available to craft brewers and in some cases to home brewers. And I think we're going to start seeing the lagers, kind of saying, like, you guys think this is what a lager is? Let me show you what a real lager is. And those are popping up, and we're just going to keep seeing more and more, strange, completely bizarre, completely experimental styles that have never been seen before. I mean, it's a really exciting time, and it's a great time to get into it.
Thank you, Zach. And we'll go from loggers to bloggers, because we're going to go to the audience for questions. I recognize part of the 21st Amendment Quality Control Committee, also a blogger at beerschool.com and a podcaster, John Foster.
So my question is, you guys make a lot of really weird beer. And given the size of huge brewing and the amount of percentage of beer drinkers that are there, what training wheel beers are you going to make to capture part of that market?
Sean, you want to answer that?
What training beers?
Training wheel.
Like gateway beers?
Gateway beers, yes.
More accessible. It's like an IPA. People are like, bleh, this doesn't taste like beer.
Well, we kind of already do that. We have a watermelon wheat beer we produce, but I...
It's one for the ladies, Sean.
It's San Francisco, easy. You start making wheat beers. You start making, those lighter beers that sort of challenge your flavor taste, what you think of what beer is or what you don't think beer is. It's just sort of like pushing them over a little bit, sort of slowly pulling them over, and you educate them. You get them involved in what you're making, what we're about. I mean, we're people up here that represent big companies, or small companies, with the people that we hire, and we care about what we do. I mean, the big breweries don't really care about beer the way we do. We only own 5% of the industry right now, of the market share. We're nothing to them. But it's important that you guys are here, and you're getting excited about it. And that's the point.
It is growing by leaps and bounds. I mean, it is a sort of the hot area segment of the industry. We have a question over here.
Yes. I was wondering if you could discuss the formation of the San Francisco Brewers Guild and also how Brews on the Bay started up.
We all participated in that. Basically, it was around 2003. And it was the continuation of collaborations that had preceded it, and this one stuck. The Brews on the Bay is the nation's premier historic ship-based beer festival. It's been going on for 7 years, is it? Sean, yeah. Do you know when the next one's coming?
I think it's coming up in, I should know this, July, I think? No.
End of August. I'm sorry, I don't know the date. Don't you know it on Twitter or something, Sean?
And it's aboard the Jeremiah O'Brien, which was one of the, what's the name of the
it's
ship?
It's a Liberty ship. It's a Liberty ship that was active.
This bright light is killing me. It's a phenomenal event. It's all SF beers. We're all aboard there. I think there's six or seven of us right now. And we need more out there, so if you're thinking about opening a brewery in San Francisco, now's the time. And we basically board this boat, and we serve our beer. We get a great turnout. It's a two-day event. You should come on out.
It's the only place you can enjoy a bunch of San Francisco beers and possibly fall off a boat at the same time. So, good times.
I want to remind the audience that this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, and tonight we're hosting San Francisco Microbrews, Get Wiser Than Bud. Also, the formation of the San Francisco Brewers Guild was something of an extension of our democratic involvement with each other, the spirit of collaboration, and the sharing with the public. So we have a Meet the Brewers event that happens every month, which is an opportunity to further the dialogue between the brewers and their friends, their customers. Do you know when that occurs?
It's Meet the Brewers is an opportunity. It moves around from location to location. You can find it at sfbrewersguild.com. Not prepared. It's an opportunity to actually meet the people that make the beers. I think there's actually one tonight for you in the audience at Bender's here in San Francisco in the Missionary, and you can go out and meet us and shake our hands and drink our beer.
We have another question?
That's right, actually. It's at Bender's bar right now, 19th and South Venice. Good job, John. My question is about the hops, and Forrest touched on this a bit, talking about the West Coast and how the West Coast is notorious for its hoppier beers. And Sean touched on this, that Fritz Maytag, with his Liberty Ale in 1976, really brought hops to new light. And it seems like what I see in the trend in the industry are all these people going for the biggest, hoppiest, craziest beer. What do you think is the future? What does the panel think about that as a future with the hop crisis going on, with the shortage of hops? Yeah. Is it going too far?
I personally think it is. I'm not into it. I'll just say it. I might get a little bit of heat from my friends down in San Diego. But I think that there's a point where it's good for us to all to kind of show off and see what we can do to push the envelope and so forth. But, I mean, at the end of the day, these beers have to be drinkable. And I think there's some beers out there that are kind of pushing that envelope a little bit. And we make some big beers. We make, the Double Daddy. It's, 9.5%, whatever. We make a 14% beer. But those are not what we traditionally sell. We're selling beer in general in the 5-7% alcohol range. And I think that that range is flavorful and enjoyable, and you can make a really balanced product. And our hops are obviously out there, but we're not. Yeah, I think there's a point where it gets a little extreme.
I think it's a male ego trip myself. And I think, I've tasted good hop beers. The European attitude about beer is balance. And anybody can brew a beer and throw 165 IBUs of bittering in it. And there's no skill in that. It just, you can't taste anything else but the hops. I have tasted good ones, but not every hoppy beer is good. And there's a few good ones out there. There's enough skill in the brewing of it that it has backbone. It has enough backbone. It has enough body in the beer to hold the hops. And there's a few of them out there. The only one that comes to mind, all these guys brew good beers. I think Big Daddy is a good beer. A lot of people like it. One of the ones I like is Damnation Ale. I think that's a really fine, hoppy beer. And it goes down easy. One of the signs of a good beer, it's not what everybody else thinks about it. It's what you think about it. And if a beer goes down easy, and you don't think about it very much, you don't try to intellectualize it and pull it apart, and there's nothing that draws your attention to the beer, it's probably a good beer. I used to go into the infamous 20 Tank brewery. He had a beer called Kinnickinnick Ale. Yeah. And it was one of the best pale ales ever made. And you could go in there and sit down in the 20-tank brewery. And the 20-tank was a real bar. It was classless. There wasn't just bankers in there or gay people in there. It was all different stratas in there, and everybody was talking to each other. That's a bar. And and you could drink a Kinnickinnick ale, and you could slide about two or three of those down without even thinking about it. And then finally you said, Jesus, that's good. If you start thinking about a beer the minute you put it in your mouth, there's something that's drawing your attention to it. Yep. And so you don't want to over-intellectualize it. I think a lot of this stuff gets over-intellectualized. And if it goes slides down easy and it tastes good, it's probably good, you know?
I'm going to steal that for my next ad campaign. Slide goes down easy, slides down. I like that.
Speaking of bars and Big Daddy, Speakeasy brews a beer, Big Daddy IPA, yes, which is...
It's a
partial reference to one of our friends,
yeah, who runs the Tornado Bar, which obviously is the pinnacle of beer culture for San Francisco, and I mean maybe the Bay Area as well. But yeah, I mean there's a lot of love there for Dave, and you know.
Well, to follow on Grizz's point, if you're looking to taste beer, yeah, and a variety of beer, some of which is brewed in the United States, brewed in the Bay Area, you can either go to a participating brew pub like 21st Amendment, or when you have open houses at Speakeasy or events or packaged products that are brewed locally or make it yourself with the equipment from Brewcraft, or many of them can be tasted at the Toronado. Next question, please.
Hi. First of all, thanks for coming down here. This has been a very thoroughly entertaining conversation.
We try.
This question is more towards the business end. Maybe Boris or Sean can answer this. What made you guys go from, you know, brewing beer in your backyard to say, you know, now my beer is good enough and well-liked enough that I can, like, make a business out of this and sell it to more people? And maybe you can, like, address some of the challenges you faced then and do now as the beer industry takes on.
Yeah, that's a great question. We've been doing this for about 12 years. At the time, there were two components to that, I guess. One was the beer itself, that there were some holes that we thought we could fill. There were some areas that we thought we could make a celebration ale from Sierra Nevada was a winter-only product, a really hoppy amber ale that we really enjoyed, and we thought, man, it would be great if we could have a beer kind of sort of like that all year round. That kind of got us thinking about it. So that was part of it. And then the other part of it, I think, is the branding part. That was the part that drew me into the business side of it in and of itself, is that, you know, that all the beers out there at the time were... And, you know, I'm an ex-Boy Scout, you know, I camped and so forth, but all the labels were trees and lakes and bears with antlers and, you know, I didn't really relate to any of it. I live in San Francisco, I'm an urban guy, and so we made a brand that we thought people would relate to, and I think that whether you're selling beer or shoes or whatever, you know, we all have associations and relationships with what we purchase and what we enjoy. And that was a big part of what we wanted to do, was to try to touch people that were urban people and relate to them.
Yeah. These are great questions. Next question, please.
Yeah, every time I go to a new bar, I always wonder if the beer I order is going to be fresh or not. And often it's not, and it always surprises and disappoints me. And so my question is just if you could talk about why the bars don't do a better job, if that's your experience, and what you can do or what other producers do to try to keep the quality of the product up.
Give me the names. No, I mean, it depends. The closer you are to Ground Zero, the better off you are typically. We have a great distributor here. As much as we're going to talk about Budweiser and whatever light, we're distributed by the Bud distributor, and they do a really amazing job for us. So we have pretty fresh beer in the market in general. I don't know offhand. It sounds like you've had some pretty bad experiences.
Well, I mean, it's just you know, either there's no head on it or it just tastes off.
Oh, that could be a glassware problem.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Is it the bar or is it the distribution?
If you're having
going wrong so often?
Yeah, that might be a staff training of the bar itself. If a glass is not washed properly, the head will not be there, and you'll see. Actually, yeah, here's a tip for the day. If you see bubbles pop, you know, coming up from the bottom of your glass, that's a dirty glass, so send it back and demand a fresh beer with a clean glass. Yeah, but I'm sorry. It should be fresh. We all strive for that. Beer is like bread, as I said earlier. But yeah, hit me with email or whatever you can do, and I'd be happy to straighten it out as best I can.
Well, I didn't have a specific experience with any of your products. I just was an open question for the industry.
Charlie,
really.
Want to hit it at all?
Yeah, real quickly, it's just about education, and it's about being going to those bars that have good beer and maybe telling the people at those bars that the beer is not that good why you don't like the beer there. Being that customer, because as a person who owns a brew pub that serves beer, I want to hear that, and that's the best feedback you can give.
Next question, please.
So I've been really lucky enough to travel around parts of the world and have really good local beer in Europe and Eastern Europe and Western Europe, in the Orient. And here in the States, if you go in the Midwest, you can get Goose Island, which is great. Mm-hmm. Of course, New Belgium and Colorado is great. Pacific Northwest is great. The beers, I've had all of your beers, they're just, San Francisco beer is just great. But when I go to Texas, they have things like Lone Star, they have things like Pearl, and like the only one I can drink there is Shinerbach. What's wrong with those people?
Wow.
I'll just throw Texas. There's Austin, then there's the rest of Texas. The only comment I can make to that end is that, and this is from a supplier standpoint, is that Texas has some odd laws and fees, and it's rather pricey to ship beer into Texas. So probably a lot of craft breweries just pass it by and make it state number 47 out of 50. That might be part of what's going on there.
Grizz, my understanding is that Alabama still outlaws homebrewing, yet they have homebrew shops. So clearly there are differences between states.
Well, a perfect place to build a home. You're not going to get rich in having a homebrew shop. Unless you go big time mail order and all that. But I always thought a good place to build a homebrew shop was right next to a dry county in the South. And you'd have more business you knew what to do with. They'd be coming across that line every day. And so I don't know why that. I have no idea why that is. I don't know.
Well, thank goodness we're not in a dry county. We're about to taste some of the fine local products. Yes, sir.
Hi, sir. Follow-up from my friend's question here about once you did get started, and this goes for Zach and Forrest and Sean, once you got started in your business, what's your goals in terms of growth? Where do you want to go, and what are the obstacles for those? Mm-hmm.
Ooh, we're in a little bit different of a situation than these guys. Schmaltz Brewing Company is significantly smaller than both Speakeasy and 21st Amendment. We're actually currently we're what's called a contract brewery, which means that we don't own our own facility. We're basically, I kind of alluded to this earlier, we're brewing out of Mendocino Brewing Company. Over in upstate New York. So basically the owner of my company works with the brewmaster of that company, and together they develop the recipes. I would say our company is definitely working towards our own facility. And unlike many breweries that start with a facility and build a brand, we started with a very fringe, marginalized the margins of the marginalized people in order to brew a beer that only the margins of those marginalized people might enjoy. We're trying to get the word out. We're trying to be as much a part of the conversation as some of these other larger breweries. And, I think eventually we just had this little company picnic this past week in New York, and really going when we went around the table and said dreams and aspirations, it was like, we want to just have like the coolest, craziest, most different, quite delicious, awesomest beers, as well as have like places for the people who are looking to drink those beers and work on building the community and building the culture. And I think that, as my coworker so eloquently put it, we're not going to get rich, but we're in it for the glory. And it's as exciting and as fun and as debaucherous of a cause as I've ever worked for, and it keeps it quite exciting.
Hey, Grizz, last word. What's your debaucherous ambition?
To see if I can make it another year.
Right on.
There you go. That's what anybody can ask.
Let's give a big hand to the panelists and our audience for the thoughts here today. Thank you all. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
L'chaim.